The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, Wes.
Here we are. Hello, Roseanne. Hello, Philadelphia. Ladies and gentlemen, another round of applause for Roseanne Cash. I, of course, live here as of 4 weeks ago.
I know. I've not forgiven you yet from leaving Brooklyn.
She kicked me out of New York.
I did not. He's very excitable. I'm just warning you.
Now, you know how we're going to kick it off? Is we're going to talk about Roseanne's wonderful new book, which is a memoir, not her first book. I will tell you, and it's been blurbed on the back. You can tell how wonderful it is because it's been blurbed by Bill Flanagan, Daniel Levitin, Chris Christopherson, Elvis Costello, Colson Whitehead, and, oh, me. So it's fantastic. You can tell that from the beginning. So you can really expect a kind of hard questioning of Roseanne tonight, a skewering. If you will, of some of her...
So looking forward to it.
Yes. But what I wanted you to do was just read from the very introduction to the book, just to kick us off before we speak about it.
I didn't know I'd be up on a stage, or I wouldn't have worn a short dress. So
would you like me to
figure out what to do with it?
Can I take my shirt off and place it over your knees?
No, I'm managing.
You look so comfortable.
Well, this is good. This is more laughs already than I had last night and the whole night, so this is great.
Was I there last night?
No, you were not. That's the whole point.
Tell him your Salman Rushdie joke.
Oh, okay. It's a good one. So last night I did an event in Washington, and they were announcing the other writers who were coming up for the series, and they said, and Salman Rushdie is coming up, so... I went up on the stage and I said, well, I'm not as prepared as Salman Rushdie, but I bet I have a better band.
That got a laugh, surely.
That got a laugh.
That got a laugh.
Yes. And I do. So a lot of people ask me why I wrote a memoir now, and I said I didn't decide to write it now. I decided to finish it now because I did start it about 10 years ago. And can I just set up the intro and say why I started it? I'm asking your permission. Okay. I lost my voice for 2.5 years, about 12 years ago. I got vocal polyps and I couldn't sing. So I developed this little cottage industry of writing essays for a lot of publications. The Oxford American, New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Martha Stewart Living. I wrote a piece about lullabies for her. And I wrote this essay called The Ties That Bind, about family and music. And it was subsequently chosen for a compilation called Best Music Writing 2000. And my editor at Viking called me up and he said, that piece is the beginning of a memoir. And I said, I'm too young to write a memoir. And he said, think about several volumes. And he sent me the work of M.F.K. Fisher, who wrote the most beautiful memoirs. And she wrote about her life by writing about food. And I thought, I could write about my life by writing about songs. I really liked that peripheral kind of approach. I wasn't interested in writing a straight chronology, but something that was framed by music and was nonlinear and... somewhat poetic, I hope. I felt I could do that. So I started writing it, but a lot of stuff kept happening in my life. I made records. I toured. I had a baby. A lot of people started dying. I had brain surgery. Life kept interrupting my memoir.
She's not making it up. It's all true.
It's all true. So after the brain surgery, which I wrote about in the book, you know... A good hard look at your mortality will motivate you. And I started thinking about what I most wanted to do in my life, what I wanted to finish. And it was two things. This record, The List, based on a list of 100 songs that my dad gave me, and I wanted to finish this memoir. So those two things I have finished since in my recovery. And I feel so much relief and happiness that I have. So I wanted to, Wes asked me to read the introduction to the book to kind of set it up. For my entire life, I've been trying to give voice to the rhythms and words that underscore, propel, and inform me. Because my peripheral vision is more acute than my direct powers of observation, and my love of an A minor chord is more charged and refined than my understanding of my own psyche, I have often attempted to explain my experiences to myself through songs, by writing them, singing them, listening to them, deconstructing them, and letting them fill me like food and water. I have charted my life through not only the songs I've composed, but the songs I've discovered, the songs that have been given to me, the songs that are a part of my legacy and ancestry. Through them, I've often found meaning and relief, while at other times I've failed to recognize or understand a theme or a rhythm until it became urgent or ingrained and I finally came across a song that captured the experience. My life has been circumscribed by music. I have learned more from songs than I ever did from any teacher in school. They are interwoven and have flowed through the most important relationships in my life with my parents, my husband, and my children. Songs have unfolded in my living room and under the spotlight. For me, music has always involved journeys, both literal and metaphoric. Sometimes I took the journey first and found the song waiting at the destination. Some songs have led me to true love. Occasionally, a song has been only a faint whisper at the periphery of a larger event, though it was always present. Many of my own songs have taken the long way around as I circled the edges of an experience, examining the placement of the furniture or the color of the room, the backbeat and the verses, the chord progression and the melody, constantly roaming and constantly curious. I dream of songs. I dream they fall down through the centuries from my distant ancestors and come to me. I dream of lullabies and sea shanties and keening cries and rhythms and stories and backbeats. I dream of the summer of love and the British invasion and the cries of Appalachia and the sound and soul of the Mississippi Delta. I have resisted so many times correcting public misperceptions about me in my life, out of pride, out of pain, or out of a longing for privacy. But I relish the opportunity to write about my life in this book, not to set any record straight, but to extend the poetry and to find the more subtle melodies and themes in a life that on reflection seems much longer than the years I have lived. Documenting one's life in the midst of living it is a strange pursuit. I have always wanted to live as a beginner, and writing a memoir in some ways defies that notion. But I consider this book as a first installment in an ongoing story. I don't know why some memories have persisted while others have faded, but I trust tenacity. So those are the memories I have written about. This is not a chronological fact check of my life, and I'm sure my sisters or my husband or my children remember some of these events very differently. I have abandoned my reliance on the external facts to support an individual truth, and everyone is entitled to his or her own. This is mine. So far, so good. More to come. More is always to come.
Now, what we're going to do is we're going to talk. I have some questions for Roseanne that'll just lead to discussion, and then we're going to play a couple of songs, and then we're going to take a Q&A to finish about 8:30. So that's the plan.
And then I sign books.
And then Roseanne signs books, exactly. So it's a full evening's entertainment for me.
No dancing.
There are aisles. Did you not start writing your memoir until that person said, there's a memoir in this? Or were you writing diaries from which you were able to draw to help you later?
I was a very... I was a journal keeper, but not consistently. So I had some journals. I didn't refer to them much. I mean, it really did start with that essay called The Ties That Bind. Mm. And sometimes when I was writing about an experience, I went back to my journals to remember exactly when it was or where it was. But, you know, the essay is what started it.
And do you think, I think it's important for people to know that it's not your first book. Certainly I read a couple of reviews that didn't mention that you had a really, I think, super book of short stories out. What year was it?
95.
Okay, 95, called Bodies of Water.
Bodies of Water.
It's a wonderful book. And in the meanwhile, I'm sure there are people here who know that because of some of this extraneous writing that you did. I remember I read the piece you read about playing the Clinton inauguration.
Right.
Which is a great story in itself. And I remember shortly after that, I met you and I was like, man, your editor is doing a great job. And, you know, and you were like, no, it's just how I write it. And I was like, she's lying.
He asked me that 3 times.
Because I'm trying to get you.
How much was that piece edited? I said, that's how I turned it in. There was no editing. He said, you're lying.
Because it's not true. And I'm just going to keep asking you the same question until you give up. But your prose style is beautiful and it's very spare and it's very pared down and it always says exactly what it means. I'd say there are very, very few wasted words in the book. For in a library, the obvious question to ask is, you know, who are the influences for the writing style, be it fiction or non-fiction? Because I would say that your fiction writing was in the same style. So who were the influences on both kind of projects?
Well, MFK Fisher, definitely, because she had a very clear-eyed style as well. Well, very spare and yet poetic. And
tell us about her.
She was a food writer. But she wrote, as I said, she wrote about her life by writing about food. So she would describe these meals and the people there, and then you would get hints of the relationships, and then suddenly you'd be taken down this road, and then there'd be another meal, and then she'd be flying somewhere, and she would describe the meal served on the airplane, you know. Back in the 50s, they served great meals on airplanes, apparently. I don't know. And then she would get to Mexico, but there was a man there. But then suddenly she was eating these chili peppers, you know. So it was all interwoven, and it was so sensual. Really loved that. And so I took her as a template in writing about songs. I read a lot of writers. But I think I write like a songwriter in a way, because I'm always looking for melody in prose. There is a rhythm, you know, and I'm always trying to find it.
You did or did not ever do any writing classes at university?
I did one. It was taught by Walter Sullivan at Vanderbilt University.
Right, I remember that in the book. Right.
And he was a phenomenal teacher, and he was part of the new agrarian movement at Vanderbilt, and knew Robert Penn Warren and Eudora Welty and all of these people. And he taught there for 47 years, I believe. And I was there right in the middle of his tenure. He'd been there 25 years or something. And he was tremendously influential because he took me seriously, number one. And I was a very bad writer. And he just kept taking me seriously and saying, write what you know, write what you know. And I took it away with me, and I think I held on to his ideals, but I didn't become a good writer for a long time.
Well, you know, being I didn't do any, you know, official kind of creative writing classes, but I think that songwriting is an incredibly good school.
Absolutely.
For writing fiction or indeed nonfiction. One of the ways it's very good, I want to see if you agree and if you can add to it, is just because it's very good, I find, it's a school for letting you have confidence simply confidence in expressing your thoughts and letting them flow out of you and perhaps not necessarily make perfect sense to begin with.
Right.
But then your process might not be like mine. But I think for me, I think songwriting is a wonderful school. Do you find that?
Absolutely. You know, yeah. Because songwriting is a very prescribed playground. Once you set up your internal rules in a song, whatever your rhyme scheme is, or, you know, if you're going to do two verses and a chorus and a bridge, however you've constructed it, you have to obey those internal rules. You have to follow it through, or else it falls apart. And you have to use economy because, you know, you're writing a 3-minute song that's married to a melody. There's not a lot of room for extraneous tangents.
Yeah.
And so that discipline was really helpful to me. And the difference being that in songwriting you can take poetic license, you know, there's no fact checker at the end of it, and write whatever you want. Writing a memoir, I felt a real responsibility not to take poetic license.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting you mention that because, of course, there are a lot of music memoirs, and I read one review of your book which said that you know, it wasn't one of those ones with, like, a picture on every page. And that's obviously a good thing because it's not the kind of a book I think that people want to read. But recently there have been a spate, I think, of slightly more interesting rock memoirs, the prime example being Bob Dylan's one
Chronicles.
Recently, which is a book, you know, completely that could only barely be called a memoir in the slightest
right.
sense because it's full of massive untruths and... And absurd plagiarisms of other people's work. So much so that when you get to through it, you're like, but I mean, the whole idea was to write a memoir. What good is it dealing in other people's memories?
He's not saying this to be mean-spirited. He is actually a Dylan, he's a walking archive. He knows everything about Dylan.
That's true. It's a wonderful book, but I mean, it's kind of more like a novel. But do you...
It's actually true. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
It's a wonderful book, but I think it's a good time, and I would totally put your music in your book in this category. I think it's a good time for rock music writing. I think it's a time when people, because the genre has been around for a little while now, it's not such a leap to have somebody actually writing intelligently about the subject.
Right.
And that's great, I think.
Yeah, and and also record making, you know, and writing a memoir, a music kind of memoir. I liked writing about making records. I wrote about every record I made, and was I pregnant, and where I was, and, you know.
These were fascinating bits of the book to me.
Yeah.
Because as somebody who follows the records, those feelings of, oh, my God, yeah, she must have been expecting a child during that. That's a strange thing to read.
Well, that's how I remember what the records, too. If I think of a certain record, I think, oh, yeah, I was 7 months pregnant when I did that vocal. But also record making, the old way to make records was very tactile. You know, analog recording was a sculptural kind of art. You used tape and air and knobs and vinyl and a big, thick vinyl mother that you pressed your vinyl records from, and you could scratch things into it, and there was a side A and a side B, and you had to build it in a certain way, and that's gone.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore. So I loved writing about that.
Well, it's almost like you're writing about, you know, steampunk.
Yeah.
It's like some weird old weird old way of doing things that doesn't exist anymore.
Like combining water with a stick.
Well, what I was going to say was, as somebody who's liked your records for a long time, and I'm sure there are many people who listen to XPN here, and I'm sure that those people are very lucky because they've been exposed to your music over the last years. But I don't think it's incorrect to say you started off more or less as a country artist.
Yeah. I mean, I was marketed through Nashville, let's
exactly.
say that.
Yes, exactly.
For the first 10 or 12 years.
Right. But as you grew, I certainly re-caught up with your career, having had records before that, around the time of Interiors.
Interiors, right.
And what really impressed me around then, and I mean, I think we have to talk about this stuff a little bit because it's a memoir and because, you know, your last name is Cash, is... What always impressed me was the way that you managed to be yourself and also be a really good member of your family.
Oh,
in other words, it's easy to rebel from some things, and it's also easy to like want to stay in the clan. But I think it's much harder, and I think a lot of children of very famous men who are in the same business have found this out too. You know, it's tough being Julian Lennon, maybe. But you are, you know, Johnny Cash's daughter. That's just as big a deal. And so I want you to, because I think it's a really important part of the book, tell us a bit about how you were conscious of that, how you dealt with it, and then how you wrote about it.
Well, it would have been harder for me if I'd been a boy. Absolutely.
Right.
And I did rebel in the beginning. You know, I wanted to find out who I was as a songwriter. I had no interest in being a performer. I wanted to be a songwriter. I thought it was a very honorable profession. And much of the book is about becoming a songwriter. And I did want to rebel and push away from my dad. I knew that anything I did would be obscured in the beginning, and that he cast such an enormous shadow that it was a challenge. I don't think it was a different experience for most young people who want to push away from their parents and find out who they are and what they do well and, you know, individuate. But because I was going into the same profession and it was my father, it was challenging. It was complicated. I moved to London for 6 months, which was a real coming of age time for me, and I wrote a chapter about that in the book.
That was when you were working for
CBS.
For his record company.
Yeah, for his record company. He got me the job. I said, I want to go to London. Okay, well, I'll get you a job at CBS. You go, I'll pay for it. You know, so it's not really rebelling too much. But it was was helpful. I did find out more about who I was. You know, Wes, I really think I pushed away longer than was graceful. You know, I was in my late 30s before I finally went, I guess I don't have to push away so much, you know, and it took a while to be magnanimous about sharing my dad with the entire world, but I kind of learned that early in my 20s. And then it took a bit longer to stop pushing away and go, okay, I've somewhat mastered this craft. I do this pretty well. I don't have to keep pushing away. And it was until I recorded September When It Comes with him, the year before he died,
right,
which is really the first time that I totally embraced everything.
It's just so fascinating. Since his death, I mean, well, there's two questions I want to ask. One, is it for the reason you said you wanted to be a songwriter, not a performer? Is that because you saw what the performing aspect of it did to your father?
Partly, and partly because of my mother's anxiety about that. I mean, in her experience, performers got addicted to drugs, were on the road all the time, and then your marriage broke up. I mean, who would want to do that? Why would you choose this as a profession?
Because it's awesome.
And I also didn't need that much attention, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
I liked the idea of being the writer in the room, sending these depth charges out in the world, you know, with just language and music. So I grew into being a performer, and I write about that at length, you know, how something that felt so alien to me came to feel like home. And my father was very good at working out his deepest problems and his own psyche under the spotlight with an audience. It was his home. It was how he worked things out in his life. And I grew into some of that myself.
And of course, since he's died, you are, in a way, you are the Cash person now. How does that feel every morning?
You know, I have a pretty thick skin and a very good discipline about not being co-opted for something that's not me.
But now, of course, it's not only you that's being co-opted. It's like the whole shebang in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't participate. You know, I'm not in the job of making him a bigger myth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not here to help people work out their projects about my dad. You can't imagine what comes across my plate.
Well, I do. I know exactly, because since I've known you, I get them to pass on to you.
Oh, and so do a lot of other people. So I don't let myself be co-opted. I'm very good about that, very disciplined, say no. But there is this legacy of music that is real and is deeply important to me, that is like our DNA, that is my ancestry, and I love it so much. And I'm the middle of that story. There's my father, there's me, and now my daughter is a musician. So I want it for her, too.
And not quite the blood, obviously, but the whole Carter tradition, which is, you know, how obviously that was not your mother, but how does that play into your sense of family?
I was very lucky to have two very strong women in my life, my mother and my stepmother, and they were completely opposite, so I got completely different things from each of them, both invaluable. One, my mother's sense of detail, work, discipline, structure, June's complete insanity, and naturalness as a performer. She could be talking to you, having a conversation while she's walking towards the stage, never break the conversation and walk right on stage and start. And the greatest story that she told me is that she was on the road with the Carter family, Mother Maybelle and the Carter family, when she was young, and they were on one of those package shows, you know, a lot of country bands going around the South. And the band that went on before them, the banjo player, didn't show up. So the guy says, "Does anybody play banjo?" And June says, "I do." So she went out and played the show with them. And she came off. She said, "Honey, I had never played banjo in my life." I said, "Well, how did you know how to do it then? How did you play the banjo?" She said, "Well, when I walked on stage, I knew how to play banjo." And that's how she thought. When you walk on stage, you know how to do anything.
We were talking earlier about that, about certain premonitions that you had as a child, as a young person, you know, at school, that you might end up being a songwriter. And there's a bit in your book that I wanted you to read. Set it up for us.
I don't even know if it was a premonition. I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know until I heard Joni Mitchell that a woman could be a songwriter. And that just opened my little brain right up. Like, she was writing about her life in a poetic way and putting it out for public discourse. This is what I want. Before that, I just knew I wanted to use language in some way. I wanted language to be my tool. So this is about that, with a little bit about being raised Catholic. I hope there are no really devout Catholics here. If there are, I totally respect you. My mother was one. Okay. But the word contrition comes from the Latin word for bruise or grind, a derivation that makes perfect sense to me as a former Catholic. Something in the drone and the rhythm of the act of contrition through my fault, through my most grievous fault, which I said to a man behind a screen in a dark confessional booth for so many years, was uniquely compelling. It took me many years to realize it wasn't my fault or even my grievous fault, however much I was drawn in by the swing of the words and the safe intimacy of confession. What all those anxiously droned acts of contrition chiefly accomplished was to break me down, bruising my sense of self permanently. Or so I thought. In any case, they had the immediate effect of making me withdraw from the truth about myself for a very long time. The truth about me, as it turned out, was unacceptable, not only to Catholicism, but to adults in general. The truth about me was not meant to fit into the system of convent school, religion, contrition, or punition. None of that mattered. I was a writer. It would save me. One day in 1990, after I had finished my album Interiors and was beginning to write the songs for The Wheel, I went to my file cabinet and aimlessly pulled out a folder of papers my mother had recently sent me of my artwork, homework, and spelling lists from the seventh grade. Leafing through them, I came upon an English project I had done on metaphors and similes. Reading the piece, I vividly remembered the excitement I had felt on being given this particular assignment, for it was the very first time in my entire career as a student that I had been excited about anything the nuns had ever asked me to do. I read through my discussion of metaphors and similes, and I could feel the thrill of my 12-year-old self coming off the page, a nascent writer in love with language, as if language were a potential lover. I came to a single page that said, in big letters I had printed very, very carefully, "A lonely road is a bodyguard." It was a metaphor I had invented, and I was pleased with myself for having chosen this powerful image over the more straightforward simile, "A lonely road is like a bodyguard." I lifted that sentence from my seventh grade project and put it directly into a song I was writing, "Sleeping in Paris." I'll sing it how it goes, how it fits in there. I'll send the angels to watch over you tonight, and you send them right back to me. A lonely road is a bodyguard if you really want it to be. That song ended up on The Wheel, and whenever I hear it now or think of it or sing it, I nod to my little girl self, and she, in the wisdom of her great distance and perspective, looks on with pleasure and the patience of one who has waited a long time to be noticed. This one line in this one song is how I know who I am and how I know I survived.
I think that's whetted our appetite for music.
Okay, we do have arms on these chairs, so it's going to be a little difficult.
It is.
Were any of you at the XPN Festival last month? Oh, yeah. So you saw Wes and I do this together before.
Now without dancing.
This is a song. I wrote about this song in the book, actually. It came from a very strange vision I had. I was playing the Cambridge Folk Festival, and I climbed up in a church tower and looked across the River Cam, and I had this vision of the water rising up and myself flying away, and it was very unsettling, and I wrote this song, and my dad died a month after I wrote the song, and I realized it was about trying to stay in the body even when you're in great pain.
Waves are breaking on the wall. The Queen of Roses spreads her arms to fly. She falls. If I had wings, I'd cut them down. Live without these dreams so I could learn to love the ground. 'Cause I wanna live inside the world. I wanna act like a real girl. I wanna know I'm not alone and the dreams are not my home. Thank you.
reaches like a ringing bell. The spires of churches, they're the last place wanders all the way through hell. The note that hangs on the gilded hall, the clanging of these empty rooms, well, I could learn to love them all.
'Cause I wanna live inside the world. I wanna act like a real girl. I wanna know I'm not alone, and the dreams aren't not my home. Dreams are not home. The waves are breaking like they do.
The spires of churches, they're the last place to enjoy the view.
If I had wings, I'd use them now,
so I could follow you and hope someone would pull me down.
'Cause I wanna live inside the world. I wanna act like a real girl. I wanna know I'm not alone, and the dreams are not my dreams, and not my dreams, and not my home. Dreams are not home.
Thank you.
You made me think about that
story. Thank you, Wes. We'll do one more song of mine.
We'll do one more song, and then we'll take some questions.
Yeah.
And I've been told to be quite strict about this. You're going to place your hands up, and then I'm going to point at you. And then that person, and that person only, will ask their question of
You're scaring me.
I know. I was told to be quite firm about it.
I like so this. I like a man who takes control of the situation.
Yes, ma'am. This next song's one of my favorite Roseanne Cash songs. I stole it quite liberally in a song of my own.
I'm very flattered that you did. I wrote this song when I was less than half as old as I am today, which is hard to believe. Your line is, "You were a precocious 15-year-old.
Yeah.
No, you didn't say it.
No. I'm still doing the maths.
You know, we should take this on the road. We got a good shtick going
actually,
on.
Actually, I hate to tell you this, but we are actually going to. We have one date in D.C., February.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Just reminding you.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's in my book. I'll get there. I always show up on time, clean and ready to go. This song, I wrote this briefly in the book, too. I was living in Los Angeles when Ricky Lee Jones's first record came out. And I was really obsessed with it. And it's so weird. I just did that XPN Friday noon thing with her. It was great. And that was the first time we'd ever met, and we hugged like we were old friends. It was amazing. And I kept thinking, there's no... The record was a lot about being on the streets. It was about street life. And I thought, there's no country song about being on the streets. And so I started writing this long poem. I distilled it down to this song. I'm a little out of tune. Whatever.
You act like you were just born tonight, face down in a memory, but feel feeling all right. So who does your past belong to today? Baby, you don't say nothing when you're feeling this way. The girls in the bar singing, who is this guy? They don't think nothing when they're telling you lies. And you look so careless when they're shooting that bull. Do you know heartaches are heroes when their pockets are full? You tell me you're trying to kill the 7-year ache and see what else your old heart can take. Boys say, what is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
Take it, Wes.
Everybody's talking, you don't hear a thing. Still uptown on your downhill swing. The boulevard's empty, why don't you come around? Baby, what is so great about sleeping downtown? There's plenty of dives to be someone you're not. Just say you're looking for something you might have forgot. And don't bother calling to say you're leaving alone. There's a fool on every corner when you're trying to get home. Just tell them you're trying to kill for 7-year ache and see what else your old heart can take. Boys say, what is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon. Tell me you're trying to kill for 7-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, what is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
Roseanne Cash.
Thank you.
So, hands. We've got a microphone. That's why we're being firm, because there's a microphone to bring to you so everybody can hear. Who would like to ask a question? There's somebody right there in the blue dress, top, shirt. You just passed.
Sorry.
Yeah, you have to. The other rule is you have to keep your hand up.
Oh, okay.
Not throughout the
Should
question.
Should I say, keep it up the whole time? Hi, Roseanne.
Hi.
I've interviewed you many times over the years, and Nicole here.
Oh, hi, Nicole.
How are you? And I've always wondered, with your books. I know when an artist puts out a record, there's a lot of pressure from maybe the record label and your fans. But in terms of writing a book, do you feel that you're scrutinized differently because of your musical career? Or, I mean, do you feel like you're being judged as an author with a book like this that's so personal but also talks so much about your musical career? Does it feel like a lot of pressure when you do something like this?
Well, it does feel like pressure because, as I said, you know, with songs and music, there's poetic license and you can obscure whatever details you want. And I did feel a responsibility to be as factual as I remembered in a memoir, because memoir by definition means, you know, that it's true, except for Bob Dylan. And but as far as scrutiny or judgment, I really do not spend a lot of time thinking about what other people are going to think. If I did, it would be incapacitating.
Right. Good.
Having said that, Jonathan Yardley in the Washington Post gave me the best review, and I love him to death, and I care what he thinks.
I mean, it's also a thorny issue made slightly thornier by the fact that, you know, what you've written is a memoir as opposed to fiction. So, I mean, it's a book about you. So any review that didn't take that into account, it would be impossible to do. Who else have we got? Right in the middle there, the man with the glasses.
I'm just curious if when you write a book or when you write a song, are your routines for doing that different? Do you write at different times of day? Or what are the experiences that you have as an author or a songwriter?
I never thought about the different times of day, but that's absolutely true. And when writing the book, my best time is early morning and, you know, like getting my son off to school. I only have one I'm getting off to school now, sadly. The others are really big. But after I get him off, I spend the rest of the morning writing. And afternoon is not so good for me. And then in the evening, some stuff will start coming. Like I'll either edit what I did that morning or something new will come. With songwriting, it's much more, it just happens. It's kind of ambient. It's kind of in the air. I'll think about a line for weeks, and then suddenly the rest of the verse will be there. Or I sit at the piano and I've got a melody going, you know, so it's kind of in and out all the time.
It can kind of happen on the fly.
Yeah, on the fly.
A lot of songs get written kind of on planes and
I've written
buses
so many songs
trains.
In transportation, in vehicles.
But you can't really write a large fiction piece in
no.
that situation.
Yeah. There's a great story of Tom Waits. He's driving the car, and he gets a great idea for a song, and he can't get it down. You know, he's alone in the car. And he finally says to the heavens, "Don't you see that I'm driving?" There was a gentleman at the back who was...
Hold on, I'm the one who's saying...
Oh, sorry.
Roseanne's chosen someone, but it's all gone completely...
No, it's just he's had his hand since
right,
the beginning,
there.
Yes.
There he is.
It's good to see you again. I hope you all had a chance to listen to the CD of the show I gave you for the drive back from Collingswood last fall. I have two questions. First, how's your health?
It's a bootlegger.
No. I do. I'm a DJ. I do radio.
Oh, Collingswood, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
How's your health? You've had some catastrophic problems. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Great.
I'm doing really well. It was a long recovery, but I'm doing good.
Well, I'd never stop recovering, I think. And the other thing is you mentioned how between the list and the memoir kind of cleared the decks. I kind of put the song Cycle of Grief of Black Cadillac into that whole process. But now that that's all cleared, have you found that the songwriting muses come courting a little bit again?
Yes. And I actually don't put Black Cadillac into a cycle with the list and this book. But I think... There were several people who reviewed the list saying, you know, that it was a continuum with Black Cadillac. I didn't see it that way at all. In fact, I saw it as the opposite of Black Cadillac. Black Cadillac was much about loss and what I had lost. And the list was about everything I found, all of those songs. That was, so that surprised me. But the book is kind of a continuum from the list because it's about legacy and ancestry in some way. And yes, I am interested in writing songs again. What are you doing?
I'm writing a book.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, I'm on tonight. we should write a song. That would be great. Here's a young man. Yes, wait for the microphone.
Hi, Roseanne. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
I'm just curious. You have excellent choice in your cover material. And I mean, before the list, I've seen you do like Ode to Billy Joel and this one great soul song, If She Doesn't Love You, Tell Her It's Over, something like that. I can't remember what it was. I saw you do it in Staten Island. But what compels you
then
to...
Then you can tell me goodbye.
Awesome song. Mm. But what compels you in your choice of cover songs, and either ones that you've done on stage or that you've included on your albums? Like, I know you've done, like, a Tom Petty song from
Steve
Rhythm
Forbes,
and Romance, and just excellent choices.
Well, number one, because I'm a songwriter, I'm looking for the songs that really move me, that I admire, that I wish I'd written, just great songs, number one. And then two, things that suit my voice, you know, something I can really wrap my voice around. There are great, great songs that I couldn't, you know, think about doing. Well, on the list, there were a lot of songs that were so gender-specific that I couldn't change it even if I wanted to. Even though I did Long Black Veil and sang it from the man's point of view, but that's from a great folk tradition of women singing about other women, and I like that. That's not done very much anymore. Because it really opens up the possibilities. Is it her daughter? Is it her sister? Is it her lover? Is it her friend? You know, it makes it a little more poignant. But some of the songs on the list, like the Jimmy Rogers song, Waiting for a Train, Jumping a Train, it just didn't make sense, you know, for a woman, a New Yorker, to sing that. And then there are some that, you know, that are really in way into jazz that I wouldn't dream of approaching. Everything else is not safe. I might go for it. I mean, I've even done a little bit of Lerner and Lowe.
I think it's so interesting that it's always the best songwriters, the very best songwriters, who do the best cover versions, because they know, there's like Harry Nilsson, you know, he did Fred Neil songs. And, you know, and Bob Dylan's cover versions are great. Your cover versions are great. Yeah. Springsteen's cover versions are great. You know, because they know the kind of songs that they like.
Yeah.
Let me just look at the time. And I think I'm going to say we have time for these two more questions, because they're the big hands, actually. Let's go here first.
Hi, Roseanne. I'm Patty. Are you going to continue the tradition and give Chelsea a list?
She asked me for one. It's a good question. In fact, her record came out last, this is my daughter she's referring to, she came out last November, and 2 weeks before it came out, she called me up and said, where's my list? And I'm working on it. You know, my dad's list and my list would definitely converge at some points, but I did grow up in another era in Southern California, so I'd have to have Neil Young and the Beatles and more Dylan and even Springsteen, you know. A couple songs from Nebraska that would be in heavy consideration. And so I'm working on it. I take it very seriously, actually. Yeah.
Did your father ever record something off Nebraska on one of
he
those
did. He recorded two
albums?
Songs
yeah,
on from Nebraska.
Thinking. He did
Highway Patrolman and
Highway
Johnny
Patrolman.
99.
Right, that's
you
right.
Know who sent him Nebraska, don't you?
All right.
He said, you would love these songs, Dad. And then he ended up recording those, too. So the first time I met Springsteen was not long after. He said, man, that really was so proud that your dad did those songs. I said, who do you think sent him Nebraska? Which is probably why he did the duet with me on Sea of Heartbreak on the list. He's payback.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Or perhaps it was that he admired you as an artist. And there was one question
more.
At the back there, and that'll be the last one for tonight. Microphone coming your way. Slowly.
Hi. My question is, when you're writing lyrics, your poetic lyrics, and you can heighten the emotional quality of them by having your melody and your music behind that, how is writing narrative different when it's separated from that heightened emotional quality that's available in music?
Killer question.
Are you a songwriter?
No, but I am a literary columnist, so we can talk anytime you want.
I knew you were a writer of some kind. Wow. I have probably a bad answer, and I want to hear your answer to that as well. I mean, it's kind of a cheap answer, but I do look for the melody in the prose, and I think that there's a rhythm of language. Language is very powerful. You know, you put two words together, they can have the force of a paragraph in some ways. And I like alliteration. I think that carries its own power and onomatopoeia. And, you know, the rhythm in language is so much more subtle, obviously, than music, but it is there. And attention to detail, kind of a visual quality, maybe, something cinematic. Not too many adjectives. I think too many adjectives ruin things.
You're not a big fan of the adjective,
are
you?
No, I'm not.
There's 12 in your book. But I mean, you know.
What's your answer, really? I'd love to hear that.
I mean, you know, it's like opera. It's like music completely changes what words mean. An opera is like when the words don't really have to mean very much. It's totally what the music's doing that gives you the entire emotion.
Yeah.
And if you take that as the ultimate example of when the words just mean very little, but the expression of them is so insane that what we do is somewhere in the middle of that,
right.
Somewhere much less than that, where we try and make the words mean a bit more and we try and make the music not do so much.
Right.
But your writing does sing to me in your memoir does sing in a beautiful way, and I'm sure that if you pick it up tonight no, I'm being quite serious, that you will find that it does too, as I have. And I think I'm going to wrap this up. And it was very nice of the Philadelphia... Hold on. It was very nice of the Philadelphia Free Library to ask me to do this. I want to say thank you to Andy. And ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Roseanne Cash.
Thank you. Thank you, Wes.
Take a bow.
Thanks, everyone. Give us a couple of minutes, and we will meet you upstairs. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.